When people ask me what they should prepare for their first opera, I usually say, prepare nothing. Don't ruin your experience before you've had it.
Hello, everybody. I'm Brian Levine, and welcome to The Gould Standard, a podcast brought to you by the Glenn Gould Foundation. And we're here once again, bringing you conversations with some of the most remarkable people from all across the world of the arts. When I mention a single word that describes the subject matter of today's episode, you will either be filled with delightful anticipation or alternately will have you immediately reaching for your mouse to click onto something, anything else. If you're in the second category, hold up a bit. Because if when I say this magic word, you have images of over-the-top histrionics, stodgy, snooty audiences, and intimidating elitism, you've got it all wrong. The art form we're talking about is vibrant, it can be edgy and up to the moment, it can be shatteringly intense or side-splittingly funny. It takes risks, it experiments, it can even be revolutionary. It combines all the other art forms rolled up into one fabulous package, and above all, it brings you some of the most amazing music and musicians on the planet. The magic word, my friends, is opera. And who better to delve into the world of wonders that opera represents than the Grand Master of one of the world's oldest and greatest opera companies, L'Opéra National de Paris. He is a great friend of the Glenn Gould Foundation, and I'm glad to welcome today Alexander Neef. Thank you for joining us, Alexander.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
I wanted this to be an easy on-ramp for the opera curious and also the opera cautious music lover. So if you don't mind, let's begin at the very beginning. What is opera?
It's not such an easy question because opera is so many things. I mean, it's an art form that's well over 400 years old. So it's gone through many, many different iterations in many different countries, different styles, different languages. It started actually with a group of researchers, one would say today, in Florence, who attempted with inventing opera to reinvent what they thought Greek tragedy had been. I think we've moved very far since those early days, but I think we've retained some elements of Greek tragedy in terms of what we talk about in opera, things that are deeply connected to the human condition, things that we have trouble dealing with when we don't see them on a stage, when we're not able to handle them presented on a stage with a distance, which in the end, for me, the genius device of Greek tragedy is to take elements of real life, everyday life, that we as humanity, as individuals, have trouble dealing with. You put them on a stage, you suggest to the audience, well, the audience thinks, you don't even suggest anything, but the audience thinks it has nothing to do with me, it's on stage, it's a play. But of course, it has everything to do with us. But through the distance that we look at it, we're able to seize it. And, you know, I don't really believe that the theater necessarily changes lives, but it changes people. And by going through that experience, which is a collective and an individual experience, because you're there with a lot of people who share the performance with you, yet you're also all by yourself, and nobody really sees the same show. And you leave the theater and you've gone through this process, who ideally is a cathartic process. And so a very ephemeral product, a performance, stays with you as you leave the theater. And if the emotion that you felt while you were there is strong enough, that's what makes people come back again and again.
So just to sort of encapsulate it, opera is plays not with music, but plays told entirely through music, that the inventors of the art form as we understand it today were a number of Italian scholars and leading to Italian composers who admired, and I think it's true of much of Western culture, saw the pinnacle of Greek culture as the golden age in which the arts reached a level that has never been achieved since, and they were trying to recreate that magic and tell the greatest stories, sometimes drawing upon mythology, sometimes not, using music as the essential through line and incorporating some things that we know were part of Greek tragedy, like a chorus. And so I think that for most people, even though it's not actually the very first, if they know a little bit about opera, they think of Monteverdi and Orfeo as sort of the starting point, and it's certainly the one that shows up sometimes in programs.
It's but, not the very first, but it's a no, good point to start.
Exactly. And in style similar to the couple, or three or four that came before it. But what you're describing is at root originally an aristocratic art form, something that was created for palaces and courts, for aristocratic patrons. When did opera get out of the regal courts and palaces and begin to find popular audiences?
I mean, when you move away slightly from the element of reinventing Greek tragedy, you broaden it slightly and you get into storytelling through music. In opera, from the very early days, there was court operas in Italy, but there was very early on also commercial opera companies, especially in Venice, who developed rather quickly, who spoke to a much broader audience that was not a court audience, where opera became very quickly not only an entertainment for the nobility, but a business, actually, because those theaters were supposed to sustain themselves through income from tickets and other revenues.
And certainly, I'm very familiar with the transition to England, with most notably Handel, but a whole host of other composers, and they were creating opera in theaters that attracted probably mostly the emerging middle-class audience, as well as the upper-class audience, and that really did become a popular entertainment, an entertainment for the masses, correct?
Yeah, I'm not sure that you could ever say it was an art form for the masses, but you're also dealing with an environment where the competition of other media was practically non-existent. When you think of opera in the 17th, 18th, 19th century, no television, no radio, no film, which changed radically in the 20th century, of course. But until then, there was very little competition. When people were looking for, I don't want to even say entertainment, let's say more media to consume, there was a little bit of printed press, a few books, and then there was music and theater.
Right, exactly. And then if I can fast forward to the late 18th century and the early 19th century and shift our focus to Vienna, we have, you know, Mozart, who in many ways is a transitional figure, because on the one hand, he did have aristocratic patrons, so did Beethoven, but he also was thinking as an entrepreneurial creator to develop a form of art that could reach a wider audience, where you didn't have to have a title or a powdered wig necessarily to attend it and enjoy the combination of drama, music, and spectacle.
Yeah, I think what's interesting about opera, it's something that started as an aristocratic art form, but it soon became something that everybody else wanted to have too. That's when you go into the commercial aspects of it, but also a lot of cities that were in competition with courts started their municipal opera houses. And it's something that repeats itself to our day, where having an opera house in your city, even in non-European context, I mean, it's a European art form, but you look at the number of opera houses that have been built in China over the last decades. You look at opera houses that are being constructed today in Saudi Arabia and other places. It has become almost like a status symbol for cultural achievement.
Absolutely. Then if I can just begin this little historical tour, moving on back to a focus on Italy in the 19th century, and you have extremely popular composers like Rossini, and from my scant knowledge of it, all across Italy, there were municipal opera companies, and they were vying to give the premieres of his operas, and he would travel from town to town. I remember speaking with a Rossini scholar who told me that one of the challenges that Rossini had was that each town, the local orchestra had a different tuning, so that you know the task faced by the singers to play his music would become rather different, because if they were as much as a couple of notches higher, the soprano having to reach for those high notes might actually find herself at the limits of her capabilities.
Well, we had a specific tuning here at the Paris Opera in the 19th century, which we called it, which doesn't exist anymore today. But I have here at the Palais Garnier, I have a stage organ, which is tuned to the Diapason Opera, which I can't use anymore today because it doesn't correspond to any tuning that we would use today.
Because for those who don't know about the mysteries of tuning, and I've spoken a little bit about how modern tuning evolved over centuries, but at least in North America, the standard A, which is kind of where we set the benchmark for pitch, is 440 cycles per second. Some European orchestras, I think, still tune a little bit sharper, a little higher at A442. I'm not sure what it is in Paris. Are you a 440 or a 442?
We're at 440.
You're a 440. Okay, so if you're not at the same tuning, believe me, folks, it's a big challenge in terms of the orchestra, also to a certain extent in terms of how some of the harmonies sound. But anyway, we're getting a little bit off the beaten track. But since you mentioned the opera in Paris, how did opera come to France? And can you give us a little bit of the history of the National Opera of Paris?
Opera came to France as a rather aristocratic art form, like it followed its origins. And there was the early beginnings of opera in the reign of Louis XIV, which really took off when he hired an Italian composer by the name of Lully, and his name very quickly became Lully, who then really invented French opera, which is interesting because until then, I think it was commonly accepted that opera as an art form from Italy would be performed in Italian wherever it was presented. And the French decided to go a different way. And I think Lully more or less explained to Louis XIV, if you want to achieve greatness in opera, you need to make it national. And our operas need to be in French. And that's how we don't call it operas, we call it evolved from the late 17th century on for almost 100 years until Gluck arrived from Vienna to revolutionize the tragédie lyrique and gave it another impulse. But until then, it was very much a royal privilege that was given to an impresario. And there were competing opera companies in Paris, but the predecessor organizations to what I run today is Lully's company.
Right. And not only in making the transition from being Giovanni Battista to Jean-Baptiste, did Lully invent in many ways what I think is now the precursors of the modern opera company, because I think the model spread far and wide. But he also arguably invented the art of conducting. Although he didn't use a baton, he had something a little different. What was he using?
Well, it was a very large, how you would call it, a
staff?
A large staff, yes, and he supposedly hurt himself with it and died from it, but I don't know how much of a legend that is.
Well, it's a great story, so I'm going to stick with it.
As Verdi would say, if it's not true, it's well made up.
Exactly. Well, it's the stuff of opera. And so it's fascinating to see how opera spread in France and, of course, how your company evolved. I just want to take one or two more little stops along the historic route, because one of the things that really strikes me about the popularity of opera takes us back to Italy and the quest for Italian independence and the role that one of the true greats of the operatic world, Giuseppe Verdi, played in that process through his art, and how essentially that really did make the art of opera an ultra-popular art form, an art form of the day and of relevance to the events of the day.
You know, it's interesting how opera became intertwined with this particular nationalist movement. I think it was mostly the desire to find a unifying factor. And it started probably before Verdi with composers like Rossini, Bellini, Donizetti, who in a way unified a country culturally that was not unified geographically. Because Italy before the 1850s was divided in the south and the kingdom of two Sicilies, and there was the papal state, and everything north of it was more or less part of the Holy Roman Empire under Austrian rule. And when the Kingdom of Savoy attempted to unify Italy, I think part of the attempt to unify the country was also to find a common musical language. And Verdi's Opus very quickly became a cipher for Italian unity. It was a code in a way, and especially Nabucco with the story of the Jews in captivity in Babylon became this metaphor for Italy that is seeking freedom and unification.
And the theme of oppression versus freedom and of captive people and so on is a recurring theme that shows up in quite a few of Verdi's works, like Aida, for example.
Yes, and Verdi, for a good part of his life, was at odds with the censors of his time, which is another element of opera and theater that emerged in the 19th century. It's a very tight control of the contents that were presented on stage and how they were presented. And it all has to do with the French Revolution, because once the French had executed the king, I think the ruling powers of Europe became extremely vigilant with regards to anything that involved gatherings, what was said, or in our case, sung, at those gatherings. And it was very, very tight control was applied on anything that was happening in a public space. So I think Verdi probably was censored much heavier than any composer of the 18th century. And he fought all his life for the relevance of his operas, because he very much considered himself a composer of his time. I mean, there's numerous examples. If we talk only about three, I mean, you look at Rigoletto, which was based on Victor Hugo's. So it's a story set at the court of France, and a sovereign that he really doesn't exhibit the best behaviors. When Verdi tried to set that story into music, the censors intervened and made him move the story from the court of France to the court of Mantua. And the message being, maybe this happens at the smaller, less important court, but it cannot happen at the big one of the big European courts. And another example being the Masked Ball, which talks about the assassination of the King of Sweden during a ball, and probably the most absurd intervention that the censors imposed on Verdi is that they made him move it from Sweden to the British colonies in America, and the King of Sweden became the governor of Boston.
Yes.
Yeah, even a piece like La Traviata, which we don't question all that much today anymore, which for Verdi was a piece of his time, a contemporary piece, and he wanted it to be contemporary. When it was first performed, the censors forced Verdi to move the story from 19th century Paris to 17th century Paris. So anything that seemed to talk about relevance or any contemporary connection was at risk to be suppressed, changed by the censors. And Verdi had to wait until the 1880s, when Italy was unified and he had become a composer that could impose the performance conditions for his works, until Traviata could be given as a contemporary piece.
It's very interesting. And not only is it interesting, but it also shows the time-honored truth that the censors are too stupid to understand that the audiences know exactly what is being talked about, even though they think that they've managed to take, by changing the context, you know, that they've managed to mystify the relevance to today. But, you know, the audiences see through all of that, which is why, if I'm not mistaken, a popular slogan during the period of struggle for nationhood was Viva Verdi, which, of course, was an acronym for, Viva...
Victor Emmanuel, King of Italy. Vittorio Emanuele, Re d'Italia.
Who was to be the monarch who would unify a sovereign country. And, well, I can't talk about Verdi without talking about the other pole star, and it's a very polarizing conversation, Verdi versus Wagner, because Wagner not only did revolutionize the art of opera, but he was a revolutionary himself and actually was exiled from Germany for many years. Your reflections on the impact that Wagner had, not just on opera, but on, in fact, all of 19th century art, culture, and thought.
Well, I think you could say that there's two watershed moments in the history of music in the 19th century. One is Beethoven 9, and the other one would be Tristan. And interestingly, I think without Beethoven, writing a fourth movement of his ninth symphony with soloists and chorus, all of Wagner's art probably would have been different, because that was a big reference for him. And then he went very far with that. He started as a revolutionary on the barricades of Dresden in 1848 and became a revolutionary in music that accepted to be sponsored by the King of Bavaria after his German exile. So there's also an interesting trajectory there from revolutionary to almost an official status as composer of the king.
Yes, and of course, Tristan not only is revolutionary because it makes a break with Wagner's earlier operas, he was moving in a very distinctive direction. His concepts on orchestration and on, you know, moving away from discrete arias to something that was more integrated into the dramatic flow of the text, but also to create essentially a new language harmonically that created a greater sense of dramatic tension. You know, for those who are, again, are opera curious, the beginning of this very lengthy opera, this musical drama, starts with a chord that has become legendary, the Tristan chord, and it is a striking dissonant chord. In other words, something that sounds a little off to the ear. And typically in the language that evolved through from the time of Bach up through, you know, the classical period and into the early Romantic period, when you have a dissonant chord, you basically resolve it with a consonant-related chord that basically ties it all up in a nice, sweet bow. And the way Wagner created dramatic tension was to keep us all in suspense as the harmonies swirl around but never quite arrive at the final consonants that brings it together. And finally, this enormous love story of two lovers who are ultimately fated to die for love in a Romeo and Juliet way, but very differently, arrives at that consonance about 4.5 hours after the initial chord. So you are kept on the edge of your seat waiting for it to happen for all that length of time. And it's truly a revolutionary concept that something could be drawn all around this harmonic language from start to finish.
Yes, I mean, I like to call Wagner the first great manipulator in music, because he developed, you could say, it's a manipulative quality. You could also say it's a seductive quality in his music that was completely absent before he started writing his music dramas. And what's interesting about that is that where we get to a point where I think as an audience member, as a listener, as a spectator, we lose a lot of freedom. Because what you find in Verdi, what you find in Mozart, they actually never judge any of their characters. You really have to bring yourself into those pieces. You can like the characters in La Traviata or not like them. You can like the characters in Don Giovanni or not. There's a lot of freedom that you have to put yourself in the piece and apply your own judgment. Whereas starting with Wagner, and then Puccini was, of course, a master in that too, it is very clear who are the good and the bad guys.
Yes. But you also mention something that is very notable in Wagner's music, which is a new spirit of eroticism. And the eroticism is expressed not only in the texts and in the storylines, but also in the musical treatment, in the orchestration, the lushness of the orchestra, which expanded tremendously under his guidance, in that kind of ambivalent harmonic language that swirls around, in the use of thematic melodic fragments, leitmotifs that evolve. All of this, you know, leads up to this enormous climactic moment when the love of Tristan and Isolde is consummated. And one person who was a little bit more on the rude side described the love death that ends the opera as the first great musical orgasm.
Yes, one could say that, and I think contemporaries were completely overwhelmed trying to capture the essence of that music. I mean, famously, the first attempted performances of Tristan in Vienna were cancelled because the orchestra found the piece unplayable. And generations of singers after that have found it unsingable. But that is a that is yet another challenge. Which brings us to another interesting point, because we have now, of course, Wagner singers in our day. And of course, there were no Wagner singers in Wagner's time.
He invented his own theater, his own concept. He created his own scenery. And he even invented a couple of instruments, like the Wagner tuba, if I'm not mistaken, but also his own unique style of singing, which carries on to this day. Enough with Wagner, and hopefully we're through this little musical walking tour through operatic history, we're piquing some people's curiosity, but I did want to touch on the 20th century when opera goes through some profound changes, and I would say the idea that there is a single set of rules about how music and how any of the arts should be created splinters off into a really stunning level of diversity and experimentation. And opera follows suit. And, you know, we could talk about many, many different examples, but just to pick two that I think are quite notable, by Alban Berg, and Lady Macbeth of Mtsensk by Dmitri Shostakovich. The latter, of course, got Shostakovich in a great deal of trouble. But I think that, in a way, they both show the level of new freedom in terms of language, in terms of the kinds of themes that could never have been dealt with earlier, and a sort of harrowing relevance to the traumatic events of the 20th century that persist on into our own period, that make opera a stunningly relevant art form for not only our time, but for all times. And I've made some fairly bold statements, but please feel free to shoot me down if you think that I've stepped beyond the bounds of what's real and what I imagine to be so.
I think you touched on something very important, is that art is always created in the context of its own time, right? And you can go back to Beethoven. Beethoven's music, without the French Revolution, without the Napoleonic Wars, would probably have been very different music. And the same is true when you go into the 20th century with the two big catastrophes of the two world wars that were traumatic elements for humanity, but also for the artists that were living through them. And I think they deeply influenced how music was written. And I mean, the two works that you brought up, Wozzeck and Lady Macbeth, were both written between the two world wars, after the catastrophe of the First World War, which was unprecedented in scale, which Berg reacted to by telling a story of a traumatized soldier. You could say it's a soldier with post-traumatic stress disorder, even though they wouldn't call it that way in those days. And Shostakovich talking about almost unprecedented violence in a more domestic environment. And they didn't even know there would be a second catastrophe following, even bigger than the first one, with the Second World War and the Holocaust, where we go into a development where, especially in Germany, who was the cause for that war, after the catastrophe of 6 years of wars and 6 million Jews being killed, amongst many, many, many other people, that Adorno declared at the time that it was not possible anymore to write tonal music, which from a distance seems a bit severe. But at the time, I think it was a very powerful reaction to what had just happened to humanity.
Right. Trauma, shattering dislocation, and a cutting of humanity loose from the moorings of what we thought were the stable foundations of civilized behavior.
Exactly. And I think you see that in those operas, when humanity unleashes its worst instincts, in a way, that you have a very powerful reaction in music on the stage to hold up a mirror, actually.
Exactly. And of course, the process continues right down to our day. You know, I'll mention this example because it's actually relevant to the work of the Glenn Gould Foundation right now, which is a contemporary American opera called Grounded, which tells the story of an American military officer, a drone operator who happens to be a woman, yeah. Right? Who ultimately experiences a traumatic effect from the work that she's doing, crashes her Reaper drone, and faces terrible consequences as a result. And I'll mention why that's relevant a little bit later, but the point is that opera is a continuing evolution that, just as people still draw enormous richness and even relevance for today because, you know, they deal with things that are intrinsically human and always remain relevant, even if they're set in remote periods, the work of Shakespeare, opera continues from its roots to still be something that conveys a powerful experience, an experience of beauty and fascination, but also has evolved into something that can be actually right up to the moment. But let me take a step back because, again, I wanted to provide a basis for the people who are not deeply enmeshed in the world of opera. And we'll get to those of you who are helping us to bring newcomers along. Thank you for your patience. But for those who are wanting to start exploring opera, first of all, there's a lot of confusing terminology. Opera seria, opera buffa, bel canto, verismo, overture, aria, recitative, and then a whole lot of different voice types, Halden tenor, the Wagner tenor voice, coloratura soprano, spinto, etc. Do you need to take a language course or bring a glossary to an opera theater to enjoy it?
See, I happen to think that you shouldn't ruin your experience before you've had it. And opera, like any other work of art, the first contact that you would have is for an emotional reaction that you encounter. If it's a painting, if it's a book, if it's a piece of music that you listen to, you will feel something. And you will feel that you like it, that you don't like it. And I think that's where the interaction starts. And if, let's say, you like it, you will want to know more about it. And I think the intellectual engagement should always come after the emotional engagement. When people ask me what they should prepare for their first opera, I usually say, prepare nothing. Don't ruin your experience. Don't ruin your experience before you've had it. And if you're interested after, read everything you want to read about it. Listen to different recordings. Feel free to explore. Also, because we have developed a fairly simple tool to help you through a performance which might not be sung in a language that you speak or understand, which is subtitles, which were actually developed by the Canadian Opera Company in the 1980s.
Where you used to be.
Yeah, my former home, and which are now practically everywhere in the world. Every opera company, I think, except for the Bayreuth Festival today, uses surtitles, and it's an incredible tool to just follow the story. And I think you really don't need anything else for a successful first contact. But I think there's something else to it, which we need to talk about. It's not about elitism, but it's about complexity. And we shouldn't suggest to especially new audiences who are not familiar with the art form that it is simple. It is complex, like a lot of what we call high art is complex, like Tolstoy is complex, Dostoevsky is complex. If you want to read, James Joyce, it's very complicated. But it's fantastic art, but you need to, some work is required to get into it. However, once you make that investment, the reward is incredible. And I think what is more important than ever in our complicated, fractured, problem-laden world, is that I think more and more people do not know how to deal with complexity anymore. And that's, in the end, when we go back to reinventing Greek tragedy by inventing opera, we could go back right to that. We need tools that teach us how to deal with complexity in real life. And we can learn that in a rather playful way by interacting with complexity in art, on a stage, in a book. And I think that is the real role, if you want, of the arts in this moment, but really at any moment, that we create playful situations that create what we call in good English transferable skills that we can take into real life and deal with real life and the problems and challenges of real life in a way that we can't if we don't have this laboratory that helps us deal with complexity.
All right, let me talk about opera companies, because you're the head of one of the great opera companies in the world. In fact, you're the head of an opera company that I would say has a greater level, speaking of complexity, than many, because you've got two major theaters, and your company also incorporates ballet as well as opera. So you've got many, many things going on all the time. But in any great work of performing art, there are two critical components. There is the creation, the work of the composer, and the person who writes the text that the musicians sing to in the case of opera. And then there is the execution, the bringing that to life in performance. And obviously, we've talked a little bit about some of those composers, from Monteverdi to Mozart, Beethoven, Rossini, Wagner, Verdi, Shostakovich, and Alban Berg. And we've left a lot out in between. In fact, whole nationalities of art, of operatic creation. And we barely touched upon, you know, an equally important component, which is the words, the libretto, the drama that the music is set to. But let's pass over that for a moment, as important as it is, and move. Well, actually, you know, if I can stick with the composer for a moment, because the composer, looks like there may be an opera happening out on the street.
Just an ambulance going by, a police.
Yes, yes. But who knows what the story is behind it? Anyway, a composer for opera has to be a master of many things. Any composer, of course, has to understand instruments and many of the basic elements that go into music: harmony, counterpoint, structure, you know, etc. But the opera composer has to go beyond, because not only do they have to create a work for an orchestra, but they also have to understand the human voice, the way voices can interact with each other. They have to understand choral music, because there are usually choirs. Sometimes they have to understand dance, because there are operas with a corps de ballet, a balletic elements as well. They have to understand drama and dramatic pacing, because they have to create a play, a dramatic work. And even if they've got a good librettist, they have to make the music serve the structure dramatically. And they also have to understand how those voices can interact with, in some cases, a very large orchestra, so that they can be heard well and create textures that ultimately serve the total dramatic experience. And if I haven't made it sound complex, then I am in error, because obviously it is a very, very challenging task that the opera composer has to meet. If you think about all of the operatic works in your repertoire, you know, are you sometimes struck by the staggering height of achievement to make all of those elements come together?
See, those composers' brains are not like other people's brains. Let's put it that way. And, you know, you get to the very extremely like genius level talented people like Mozart, like Richard Strauss, for example, who's supposed to have composed with one hand while playing chess with the other. Or, you know, Mozart saying, oh, well, I have Mozart listening to music that he heard as a child, music that was not supposed to leave the Vatican or at the time, that he was able to transcribe from memory later on. That is quite fascinating. To have that capacity of imagining something, putting it on the page, but not only in terms of what seemed realistic and possible in any given time. I think any great composer has tried to push the limits of the art form, which includes pushing the limits of what instruments can do, which leads to the development of new instruments that respond to something that, you know, has been devised for instruments that weren't quite up to that, or even pushing the limits of the voice and of singing. And we spoke about, there were no Wagner singers in Wagner's time, because Wagner essentially faced a generation of singers that were taught bel canto technique, and they needed to find a way to sing music that had very little to do with bel canto, not only because there was a much larger orchestra in the pit, and you have other elements, you know, halls getting bigger, there's constant evolution. And I think the true driver of that evolution are the artists. And it's the way it should be, that you don't follow a trend. And I think when you look at the repertoire that's today performed in the opera houses of the world, we have the extreme privilege to put together seasons that are composed of the with the masterpieces of 400 years of opera. And we can really follow the way composers pushed the limits over and over again and pushed into their own time, reflected on their own time, and really wrestled and struggled with realizing a vision that to their contemporaries very often seemed completely out of place, surreal, but also for the longest time, and I think this is maybe a Wagnerian thing, there was no thinking about posterity. Like, I think Mozart would be very surprised to see that his operas are still performed today, because they were very much into, let's say, daily consumption of their art with no pretension of eternal fame and glory.
Right. Yeah, we have tended to wrap the art in a kind of a cellophane of posterity, and that can be a little bit of a double-edged sword, because even though we've talked about the depth that opera can achieve and the intensity that opera can achieve, opera can also be extremely funny, and invariably, it's a lot of fun to go to opera. And part of that is the brilliance with which it is realized on stage. And I'd like to finish, if we could, with just a little bit of a picture about how an opera production gets made. Because obviously, you're at the top of a great opera company. You know, when you have, let's say, a new production, something that is going to be either a work that's in the repertoire, but you want a brand new production, or when you commission a composer to write a new work, you're basically creating something from scratch. What does that process look like?
Well, it's a complex and long process, and it starts with a creator's brain who is a composer who often works with a librettist. Sometimes the composer is his or her own librettist, and then you have to hand the baby over to the people who will perform it. That's where the director comes in, that's where the conductor comes in, where the cast comes in, and you multiply the number of people, because it takes literally hundreds of people to put on a production, a performance of an opera, which is the thing that makes it so expensive today, that you have to pay hundreds of people to put on a performance, and you need to pay them, you know, a fairly decent wage that has a relationship with what they are highly qualified to do, which is the true magic of opera, which, you know, it starts on a page and then it travels from a page with music on it, on a stage. And in a way, it in the process, it becomes much, much bigger. But it also dematerializes, because our product, as you know, as lavish, as big as it might be, it happens in the moment. And it, when the performance is over, it's finished. And even when you film it, when you record it, it's never quite the same, and it's different every time.
Absolutely. But, okay, so you have a director, and the director may have a conception. You have a scenic designer who decides, and presumably works very closely with the director, to realize that director's vision of how this drama will unfold, both on stage and also in the pit, in the musical sense, and how those elements will interact. You have a chorus, you have a costume designer, you have a conductor with an orchestra who presumably is going to have to go through rehearsals, and some of those start off as piano rehearsals. How do these, like, is there a sequence in which these things typically take place and evolve? And does your music director have engagement with all of the elements from the beginning, or does the, you know, the role of the, you know, the orchestral and musical direction come in at a later stage? These are things that I'm not clear on. So,
well, I think it really depends. I mean, what I like to do is I like to build teams of people that work together well early on. In an ideal situation, let's say the piece has been written and is ready to be performed, you would first try to find a conductor and a director who will, both on their sides, realize that piece on stage and in the pit for you. And you would work with them to find a cast that they want to work with, because not everybody works with everybody. And what you want is to put people together that will work together successfully. And ideally, in a staged opera, you would have a conductor who is very present in piano rehearsals already, because nothing is more relative than the question of tempo, for example. And even if you have metronome markings, there's a lot of dramatic intention that can be shaped by understanding the intention of the stage and how you shape a phrase, also what tempo is actually comfortable for the singer. And you get into territory where very, very few things are absolute, which might be the biggest difference between opera and symphonic music, is that in symphonic music, tempo is something that's much more strictly defined. Whereas in opera, it asks for a capacity of listening to each other. It's, again, it's different every night, and a capacity of being flexible, adapting. And so in the end, opera works best or is the most successful when from the beginning of the rehearsal process, there has been mutual listening and building of understanding. And I think when we have the really powerful impact of a performance, then usually that has happened. Because you tried, it's essentially you to try to create a solid structure over the process of rehearsals where everybody feels so secure that in performance they can be free.
Yes. And of course, as the world has evolved, the concept of what is possible on an operatic stage has evolved too, so that now we have, of course, a lot more technological possibilities, which create really magical experiences. I mean, things that really defy your expectation and leave you exiting the theater saying, how did they do that? I don't understand. It literally was magical. But also the demands on the singers have become greater because, you know, there's a stereotype in the old day, the singer would come out in the center of the stage, plant themselves on the stage. Usually if it was a tenor, we used to have this joke in my previous life that they would put their thumb out and gesticulate with their thumb. And, you know, that's a school that we now sometimes disparagingly call park and bark, right?
Yes, and that, I think it's something that's really come into opera, at least into serious opera. I think for comic opera, there was always an element of acting that was required. But I think before the 20th century, before Wagner, actually, the idea of singers acting their parts was something that was not really expected by the audience. And then we come into competition with other media. I think we're today having a credibility problem as opera. If we have performers on stage that cannot act their parts, the audience, which is trained by the aesthetics of television and film, will not find that believable. So it's, again, opera, I think, had to adapt to that, and I think adapt to it for the better. But it's in the history of the art form, a rather recent phenomenon. You know, there's this famous story when Rudolf Bing took over the Met, and he produced for his opening new production of Don Carlo with Tebaldi, Björling, and many other famous people. And they were all asked to be there 2 weeks before opening for rehearsals, and nobody really quite knew what they were supposed to be doing 2 weeks before the opening. And, you know, we've evolved from there. I mean, here we would rehearse a new production in about 6 weeks now, a revival between 3 and 4, in order to have something that really represents musically and dramatically the demands of the composer.
And a singer may have to sing in postures and positions that would have been unimaginable in earlier generations, lying down, climbing stairs, running.
Yeah, I mean, ideally you would agree on that in rehearsal so that everybody feels they can do their best. And I think singers will make themselves known when they actually cannot sing in a certain position, as they should. And any conductor and director who take their job seriously would listen to that. It's, in a way, when you talk about posture on stage, it's like for a conductor to ask a singer to sing a tempo that's not singable for them.
Exactly.
Right.
So there's a meeting point, a balancing point where, you know, the ability to fully realize the dramatic intentions also has to run into a meeting point with what's physically possible for a singer to achieve while maintaining breath control and, you know, reaching the audience and so on. But one of the things, and I don't want to keep you too much longer, but that has really struck me is how the range of possibilities in opera has just expanded exponentially. Now we can have things that are quite magnificently unrealistic. You know, I'm thinking about, for example, some of the productions that the South African designer, director William Kentridge has imagined, you know, where you have puppetry and animation and projections, and they don't strive to be realistic. They strive to create a kind of a psychological and almost, surrealistic in some cases, or what I call beyond realistic experience. The others that still maintain a kind of a grandeur and an opulence, like those classic Franco Zeffirelli productions that will never be banished because people love them so much, Bohème, Traviata, so on, Tosca. And then some that are really powerfully intimate because they are so minimalistic that they bring you into such a sharp contact with the drama and with the performance of the singers. And sometimes, that less is more becomes even more intense and powerful. It really has expanded tremendously in terms of what can be achieved and what audiences are prepared to experience when they come to an operatic performance. Have you found, and certainly I think in general, Europe has been farther along in terms of the avant-garde, in terms of taking us into new realms. But, we're not that far behind in North America. We're sort of following in that tradition that great directors like Robert Wilson and Peter Sellers have brought to us. What do you, as you look at putting together a whole season, do you try to balance that range of different approaches so that you have a little something for different ranges of tastes? And, how do you begin to think of that programming challenge?
I wouldn't put it that way. I think what's really important is that we make strong artistic statements and that we don't mandate our artists to express themselves one way or the other. Because in the end, what we do today, when most of the repertoire that we present is historic, we need actually artists of today to read pieces of the repertoire for an audience of today. And they give us their personal reading, which implies that there's not one truth about a piece, which I think is a very significant element of why opera is still alive, because we look at this, the material, I believe, doesn't change a lot. But the way we look at the material changes because we have a different background from the people who first experienced the pieces and the people who experienced them in the last 50, 100, 200 years. And I think it's very important to give artists that freedom to say, this is what I see in this piece. Because the artists are, in the end, are the bridge between us and the material. And then those can be very personal statements. It doesn't necessarily mandate if it looks traditional or modern. What I find important, and we should probably end on that note, is that we've spoken about opera as an art form in competition with media today that didn't exist when the art form was born. And, we look at the 19th century when this company here in Paris was highly regarded for the realism of its productions. The realism of the 19th century, of course, very much falls behind what you can realize with special effects and computer animation today. So I think it's not a field that we should compete in today, because there's other media that have taken over realism from us, and we can't do it as well as they do. There's a big, we have to question ourselves as an art form in an environment that has changed a lot, and where's our place? What do we well? What do we better than other media, other art forms? And I think it's also incredibly important that we always consider there needs to be a place for the audience to put themselves into what's going on stage. It can't be too prescriptive. It can't answer all the questions right away. There needs to be a space for the audience, individually and collectively, to make themselves part of the performance, because otherwise the performance is actually not happening.
Absolutely. Well, in closing, opera, I will make a declarative statement. Opera is for everyone if you give it a chance, and I encourage people to do it. If you're in Paris or can get to Paris, go to the L'Opéra National de Paris. It is opera in the most beautiful and grand style. And if you visit the Palais Garnier, you'll see a real palace. And if you've seen the Phantom of the Opera, something or other may look familiar to you about that venue. I also want to thank you, Alexander, for being on the jury that chose the laureate of the Glenn Gould Prize for us for this year, Elton John. And if you needed more proof than opera is for everyone, that great master of popular music and rock, Elton John, chose a young Canadian opera singer, Emily D'Angelo, as the winner of the Glenn Gould Protégé Prize. And I think you've probably encountered Emily along the way.
I couldn't be more delighted for Emily, who was a young artist at the Canadian Opera Company not so long ago, and who has embarked on a spectacular career since. And I think the choice of Elton John is really very, very inspired.
You know, I think that it was partly due to your work along with your fellow jurors. And of course, Emily is someone that I have huge admiration, because she is in every sense a great singer in the classic style, but also a supremely contemporary artist who is really helping to bridge the gap in terms of experience. And of course, that opera that I refer to, Grounded, about the drone operator, was a role that she created for the Metropolitan Opera and other companies. So that brings us back to our starting point, which is, if you've never been to an opera, don't watch it on a film. Don't do anything other than get yourself a ticket, pick a nice entry point opera, let's say, one of the three or four biggies, like Carmen, La Boheme, The Magic Flute, something that you'll find fairly easy to get your head around that has a lot of very beautiful and appealing music, and give it a try. And if you're inspired to try it, please tell us about your experience. Put it in the comments section of this video, because I personally, and I think Alexander, would very much be interested in hearing about your experience. You folks are the future of opera. Help us to keep it alive, evolving, and growing on into the future. Alexander, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me, Brian.
The Glenn Gould Foundation is a registered Canadian charity, and we rely on the support of arts lovers like you to keep bringing inspiring stories to life. Please consider giving by visiting our website, glenngould.ca, and follow us across social media at the Glenn Gould Foundation. Thank you so much for joining us for this episode of The Gould Standard.